This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Thanks for joining us again this week to enjoy another conversation with a conjurer. Last week we had Doc Eason, who is internationally known not only just as a bar magician, but a great lecturer who has toured the world with his lecture. Well, this week we go virtually across the pond over to London to visit with someone else who is internationally known as an actor. He is a star of both stage and screen, been not just on film, but on BBC. You've perhaps seen him here in the United States in Ghost Stories. There are many other films he's been a part of. I had recently watched him on the Netflix series Peaky Blinders, in which he played Churchill. Anyhow, we'll talk a little bit about that at the beginning of this. But beyond that, he is also the person who is, I wouldn't say behind, but a co-writer and producer of many of Darren Brown's shows. In fact, I believe they're working on their eighth collaboration together and won many awards for his work with Darren Brown as well as independently. There was an actor back in the early 20s, 1920s, 100 years ago, Lon Chaney, who was known as the Man of a Thousand Faces. And he was an internationally known actor at the time also. And I am entitling this podcast as Andy Nyman, the magician with many faces, because indeed he does. And as an actor, you have to be able to take on all these different roles. So you're not always necessarily going to be typecast as the same type of person. And as a result, he does take on a different character, and he grows his beard or has his face in different ways. It looks different in all of his movies and everything. Anyhow, he also is just a multifaceted individual as far as where his mind goes for magic and mentalism. Man, there is just so many gems in this. There are not just a few nuggets here. You can find the gold easily, and I know you're going to enjoy it. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Andy Nyman, here on The Magic Word. Today I have with me someone that I have been wanting to talk to for quite some long time. This has been, again, a long time coming, and as we are getting deep into the archives of the Magic Word Podcast, it's about time that we finally get around to this young man. My guest today is Andy Nyman, and he is someone who should be well-known to you. He is well-known not only throughout the UK, but then I believe globally because of his IMDb attributes, the different things, the movies and things that he's been in. Plus, of course, you know that he's worked with Darren Brown, as it would say on Wikipedia, as an accomplished magician and a mentalist. Nyman has frequently collaborated with Darren Brown. He's co-creator and co-writer of the TV series Darren Brown Mind Control and Trick of the Mind. He and Darren wrote Russian Roulette, Seance, and Messiah, as well as three series of Trick of the Mind. He co-wrote and co-directed four of Brown's stage shows, all of which have toured and played the West End. For Something Wicked This Way Comes, they were awarded the 2006 Oliver Award for the Best Entertainment. In fact, speaking of awards, that he has won not only the Oliver Award back in 2006, but also, I believe, that same year had the Cherbourg, thank you, Cherbourg Octaville Festival of Irish and British Film Best Actor for Shut Up and Shoot Me. Also, he is a member of the Intermagic Circle, MIMC, is that right? Mm-hmm. Sure, with Gold Star. And also that, again, he has a lot of credits, not only in film, but also in working in plays. And I was recently on a Magic Circle lecture listening and noticed that he was one of the people. And I just had sent him a private message to say I enjoyed his performance as Churchill on Peaky Blinders that I was watching on Netflix, which if you're looking for something to binge watch, it's a great little series. And he plays Winston Churchill. And it's like, oh, it's Andy Nyman. And so he said, well, good. I said, you did a great job. And he said, well, I like your podcast. And I said, well, can you be on? He said, let's do it. So here he is. Please welcome my friend, Mr. Andy Nyman. Hey, Andy.
Oh, lovely to see you. Having only heard your voice, your lovely voice on the podcast for
so many times. It's really nice to meet and have the honor of doing this, so thank you for asking.
Well, I believe that the times that I have been in England that our paths haven't crossed because you were busy doing one thing or another, that I was touring over there, doing a lecture tour. Ooh, when was that, 2015 maybe, or maybe 2012? Mm-hmm. It's been some time ago, and including the Circle, but then also at Blackpool. We were talking just a little bit beforehand about going to Blackpool, and I was there 1 year with Banachek, and we were selling his books and everything, whenever we were rolling out the reprint of Psychological Subtleties number one, that we had that print over there by Leopard Printing. And so then we did that. Anyhow, that was my first time in Blackpool. We were talking about, yeah, that's not really the playground that it used to be. And
it's amazing, Blackpool, isn't it? I mean, if you look at photos of Blackpool right the way through from like the 1800s through to about the 1950s and 60s, I mean, it was unbelievably glamorous, Blackpool, and gets less glamorous as you get to the sort of 50s 60s, but mm-hmm. was a phenomenally exciting home of sort of light entertainment, and then it's sort of dwindled over the past 20 years probably.
You think it's just because they hadn't done anything to it, in other words, that
I think they haven't invested in it in the way that they might have done. I think that it's just the way a lot of other town centres and things in the UK have gone. It's sort of, it needs a bit of tender loving care and investment, and it needs to be brought back to its former glory, because, you know, those, when you go to the magic convention in Blackpool, which is, I think, probably the biggest magic convention in the world,
it is larger than FISM.
5,000 people or something there, and you go into that Winter Gardens theatre, it takes your breath away, and that Winter Gardens complex is just extraordinary. So I love Blackpool, and I loved it a lot when I was a kid. It kind of breaks my heart a bit now, because it is, you know, a shadow of its former self, but you kind of hope that it's all there, it just needs dusting off, polishing up, pouring some money into it, and, you know, people will flock back.
Well, now, that was what was called a holiday camp, so that people from the UK used to spend the summer there, I guess, not unlike what the Poconos are, used to be in the US.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the big difference is you were guaranteed sunshine. Whereas, that's the one thing, sadly, in the UK.
Well, it is England.
In what is known as breezy Blackpool, you know, the one thing you are guaranteed is chilly wind, even if it's sort of beautifully sunny.
But they have a lot of places there for plays and shows and live entertainment. And there was, as I recall, something kind of like a tower, not like an Eiffel Tower, but what was that?
Yeah, it is the Blackpool Tower. It's really famous, and it's extraordinary, the Blackpool Tower. It's got a working circus in there that's brilliant, and the second half of the circus, they flood the ring, and there's a sort of pirate ship spectacular show that takes place in it, and they used to have elephants in there, and I mean, really, it's a feat of engineering. There's a waxworks museum in there. It is a sort of I don't really know the history of the thing, but it's a copy of the Eiffel Tower, and it's absolutely, it's really, that's the thing, you know, as you're driving to Blackpool as a kid, it would always be, my dad would always say, right, shout who sees the tower first. And as you're driving up the road, you, any pylon you pass, is that it, Dad? Not yet, you know, and then you'd suddenly see, that's it. And there's no excitement like it, knowing, God, we're here. And I still feel that when I go to Blackpool for the convention. You know, I can't wait to go again. I was there 2 years ago, me and my son always go, or have done over the past sort of decade, really, and just love it.
Is he a magician also, or like magic, or just,
well,
kind of
follow suit? He's an actor, and does magic, and is now creating magic, and is really good and really creative, and has got a couple of things coming out with Penguin, but has sort of inherited from me my love of a good gimmick and my love of old school stuff. He's like me, not really interested in cardistry or the latest, coolest thing. He would much rather be grabbing, you know, my Carol Fox books, looking through those, looking through Supreme stuff, looking through Lewis Ganson stuff, finding crazy, brilliant old ideas and trying to sort of reinvent them or come up with his own versions of that. And I think that's a really interesting part of magic that gets neglected. It's seen as something that is for the hobbyist, mm-hmm. sort of the toy, the gimmick, the sort of, I don't mean card gimmicks, the magical props, the strange looking items.
Right.
And I think it's a terrible, terrible mistake on the part of younger modern magicians, because there is such power in those odd objects, in those strange, in the world of the internet where you can get and find anything. Where did that weird little box the coin slides into come from? Right. You know what I mean? I think there's a real mystery and a wonder that goes with those things. So I love all that, as does my son Preston.
Well, that's true. There are a lot of really great secrets and mysteries that are in the old books. And I don't believe people certainly read like they used to, or if they do, it's just a book that has two or three tricks in it. There aren't a lot of books published now. I mean, for a while, there was a proliferation of books whenever we had desktop publishing, and it made it so much easier for you to do this at home. And then it got so that people were doing one trick in a DVD or something. And so I believe just with a shorter attention span, and I would blame that on the internet and television and sound bites and everything else you see, that we're not interested in the older stuff.
I don't read like I used to.
Admittedly, me too.
I go over, I pull out the magic books I had when I started doing magic, and I would buy a book. I'd buy like a John Bannon book or whatever I might have bought.
Sure.
I'd read and work on every trick, find the ones I liked, right in the index. Brilliant. Love this one. Cross, not for me. Yes. I get a book now and it's like I'll read a trick, fall asleep, go back to it a week later, have another little look. Did I read that one? Oh yeah, you know. Let's try this one. Let's have a look through that. I don't know that I get bored. I hate myself for not having the same impetus to read that I used to do with magic books. I find it harder to read them. Now, some of that, I think, is about the way they're written as opposed to...
You talk about the author, the way that the author writes?
I think sometimes I get frustrated with po-faced art, in inverted commas, within mm-hmm. our art. Mm-hmm. You know, I love tricks. I love a good trick. And I love the good. Now, don't get me wrong. You know, I like going into the detail every day. You know, my writing has always been, I like to try and cover every single aspect and every detail of the plot, the script that I'd give you to do with it. And the reasoning behind everything, why I think this makes the moment better, why that would make the magic stronger in the end. But I think sometimes magic can be written in such a pompous, flowery way.
True.
Drives me a bit mad.
Well, some people are just not, they may be creative, but they're not good writers. I love David Riegel. I love Stephen Mensch, Max Maven. Yeah. There are three top writers right there. Jim Steinmeier is, I love just the poetry of their writing and the explanation of their tricks. It's like I can go back and reread that then again. It's just, it's excellent.
Yeah. Absolutely.
In trying to pick up some of these old books, you got your son's got the right idea. You've trained him right to go back and actually look at these gems. And I've got 1,000 books in my library back over here then, too, that I will go back to. And I'm kind of getting to that point in my life. Well, do I really need them anymore? And so I'm thinking about starting to trim down some of my collection and then saying, okay, dividing them into a red, green, and yellow. Like, you know, some that's like, okay, I don't need that anymore. Some I might need, but then green, I really want to keep that one, you know.
I think that's a really good thing to do, though. I did that not long ago. And every now and then I do it and I either sell some off or I'll give them away or, you know, and it's quite useful because you really find and remember, oh, I love that book. Mm-hmm. I almost gave one away the other day. And there's not one iota of material in it I'm ever going to do, ever. But there's just something about when I got the book that I think, oh, no, I want to keep that. I want to keep it. Sentimentally, I have to keep that one. I'll give something else. But I think it's useful to do that. Another thing that I think is really brilliant about books versus downloads, and don't get me wrong, I love a download. I do. I love the thing of it. But I don't believe what you have. So when I think about the tricks that I do, I don't mean the ones that I've invented. I mean tricks that I learned from books over the years that might be the go-to tricks that I would choose to do if I'm with magicians or what have you. I feel that I have earned that material because I've read and worked on 5,000 tricks, for argument's sake, of which I've only kept 12.
Yeah.
So I feel I've put the work in to find those self-workers or the ones that under any condition I think, oh, that is going to absolutely kill them. That's going to destroy them now. I'm going to set up for that and do it in 20 minutes or whatever. You know, I love that. Whereas you don't get that feeling of ownership if all you're doing is downloading and watching someone else do it. To me, it goes beyond. There's an ease to that.
Mm-hmm.
Where there isn't an ease, it's the opposite with a book.
Which it should be.
Yeah. It's a constant level of commitment that you have to give to it.
That's an excellent point. A constant level of commitment that you have to give to that. You have to stay focused on what it is that they're talking about. As an example, like when the Harry Potter books had come out, they were excellent. But when the movie came out, suddenly that your visual, you know, your idea of what Harry Potter looks like is now this actor. And so it's no longer who you may have visualized. Likewise, that whenever you're reading a book that you may think, OK, well, it's a certain way. But then when you watch a DVD, it's like, oh, well, I guess I had my hand the other way. Should have been the other way around or whatever. But the point is that when you're reading through that, and if you're not understanding that correctly, you may be inventing your own new idea or new way of doing something.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. And often I had a thing recently where I've got another trick that's coming out. Later in the year, maybe. And it's based on a thing that was one of the very first tricks I ever bought when I was a kid that I knew. And again, I bought it from the magic shop in Leicester, which was where I grew up. And it was one of those classic things where they have just put this thing out. It's nicked. There's no credit to whose it was. It's just one of the tricks that they happen to sell. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that with a nasty cynical edge. It's just that's kind of the way of the world of those things. You know, I'm sure you're going to, you know, and this was the Magic Spots ESP matchup or whatever it was called.
OK.
So it turns out, as I'm looking into it and researching it, because all these years I've known that and I've thought, I wonder what that move actually is. And I try and find it and I can't find it. So, of course, I do the Oracle, which is I email Max Maven or speak to Max.
Of course.
God bless him. I've known for years and I'm honored to count as a friend. So I say, Max, do you know what this thing is? Well, of course. Not only does he know what it is, he gives me a million references.
References,
that are
right.
Just extraordinary. He's encyclopedic. It's amazing.
Right.
And it's a Paul Curry thing. That I didn't realize this move was. Brilliant Paul Curry thing. So I buy the Paul Curry book because I feel, well, this is a Paul Curry move. The move is in the book. I should buy this new Paul Curry book because I don't own one. And just because I feel I owe it to his estate to do that if I'm going to be putting something out that credits him.
That's a good thing to do.
So in the book is out of this world.
Sure.
His manuscript for that, which I've done forever, the version I was taught of it. I've never sat and read the Paul Curry Out of This World. Holy shit, it is mind-blowingly brilliant. And it is not the trick that everybody does. It's, you know, it is, but the psychological wrinkles in the book, in the manuscript, are so brilliant and so elegant and deceptive. I was just thrilled to read it.
Gobsmacked.
Because it was like, and I learned this thing and called Preston, my son, and was like, come on, look at this. I know you know the trick, but don't worry about that. Let's just do this. And I did it. And he was like, wow. But what was that? How's that? you know, that little moment there. I'm like, I know. That's the reason I wanted to show you. How brilliant is that piece of thinking? Just, you know, just touches that you think, oh, that's amazing.
So what you're saying, I guess, that a lot of us need to go back to the original, to the source, because this has been like playing telephone, that it's passed on to someone else and they've got a variation and their variation. And when you finally learn it from somebody, it's like a 16th variation. And I had a story about, and I was at the 4F convention, in fact, there's Finger Flicking Frolic some years ago. And I was sitting at the bar back when we were at the Forks Hotel, and I was doing this card trick, and I was showing this older gentleman who was like in his 80s, I guess, at the time or something. And as I was doing that, then I knew the name of the trick was called Dave's Delight. And so and he said, well, the way I invented it was actually this way. And then he started showing it to me. And then I looked at his name tag, and it was Dave Letterman with a D, Letterman. And And so it's like, oh, you're Dave. It's like, and so he showed me the original work on that. It's like, oh, it's like, yes, sir. I'm sorry. Now I get it. That was quite a moment.
Wow. That's absolutely wonderful, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I had that again. There's a card trick that I have done for 20 plus years, and it's an absolute favorite of mine. It's just, it floors magicians and it's in Greater Magic. Okay. And recently someone was talking to me and they were like, have you got Greater Magic? I was like, I have. Yeah. He said, it's just, I can't believe how good it is. There's everything in there. So I thought, you know what? I haven't looked at it. I got that Kaufman one when it came out years ago, and I thought, I haven't looked at it for years. And it's because it's daunting. You know,
it's a big, thick book. Yeah.
It's like picking up a kettlebell. You know, I mean, it's. I'm just doing five rounds of lifting Greater Magic. Hang on a sec. So you lift this thing up. Is that big? And I thought, I've
you
got
get that in one hand, an Al Baker book, and the other one, you know.
Oh, I mean, literally, those two books, you're done. What else do you need? That Greater Magic, Al Baker, Mark Wilson, you could put everything else away.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, literally, you'd never need anything else. Anyway, I'm looking through the book, and I'm thinking, geez, this is unbelievable. But I think I've got to find the trick, actually, that is the trick. I can't quite remember who it's by. So it takes me an hour at least to go back and forth to try and find, I think I know who it is. And the same thing. I reread this trick. I've been doing it wrong for 20 years, but what I've been doing is my version of it.
Sure.
And I love that, because you kind of ditch little things that you subconsciously you're learning and you think, I can't do that. Or I don't really need that, or whatever it is. And you craft this thing over time into your thing.
With your personality. Yeah. You put your stamp on it, your signature. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in that regard, you were talking about, obviously, we know thousands of things and see all these things at conventions and new tricks that are coming out and lectures, and you get a lot of really great ideas and everything. But then it kind of comes down to about a dozen things that are going to be in your act, and they kind of stay in your act. There was one of the ideas, I think this came from you, that I had for years and years and years. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe this was yours, in which that I had a movie review book, like Blockbuster book, and you go through and they would select the movie, and that would be then written on the Blockbuster card with their number and everything. Wasn't that yours?
It is mine. Yes. Yeah, it's called Deep Red Prediction.
That was awesome. And I have,
thank you.
I use that even as a closer. I had it in the middle part, and people were coming up and asking me later, saying, can I see that book? You know, and said, well, that really is
very, very happy. Yeah.
But I love that. Yeah. You know, for your point is that we have certain things that then we stay with because it's solid. You know, it's going to be working, and that's kind of what makes your reputation then too. But when you're starting to write something, and we're talking about, you know, Darren Brown and things that, in fact, the Something Wicked This Way Comes. I've got that poster signed actually downstairs. Some of my mates from Scotland had sent this to me as a gift a while back, I didn't get to see the play. Obviously, it must have been great because you had won the awards. But when you're writing one play after another, do you scrap everything and then kind of start all over? And how do you actually go about doing that? I mean, obviously you're building on what you've done before, and you've got a brand. So how do you?
Well, it's like every other creative product, which is it's like pulling teeth. It's unbelievably hard to do. Challenging, daunting, frightening. You're riddled with imposter syndrome. Doesn't matter how many awards you've won or how many other shows you've created.
Imposter syndrome, what do you mean?
Oh, God, it's the most brilliant expression. It's the psychological state you find yourself in where you think, I'm not good enough to do this. I can't do this. I'm an imposter. They're going to find me out. They're going to find out this time when I get onto set to play this role, they're going to realize he can't act. He's terrible. Or when you go into the show to write or direct the show, you know, everyone's going to be looking around going, oh, my God, I thought he was supposed to be good. He's won an award. He can't do it. He's a total imposter. So it's a psychological state called imposter syndrome.
I see.
But most people have at given points. You just don't know the name. Not you don't, but many people don't know the name for it. And that's what it's called. You feel like an imposter when you're going to start your lecture. And, you know, it's one thing to go, OK, well, I'm doing my lecture to the Idaho rabbits, and there are 12 of them here on this wet, crappy Wednesday night. And I'm not going to sell any lecture notes. I can tell that already. But here we go. And you're fine. But the minute you do the same lecture at 4Fs or FISM or Blackpool, and there's 3,000 people there, and you get up and you think, I'm going to die on my ass. This material's terrible.
Gotcha.
They're going to start walking out because they've seen it before and they know it's not very good. What are you doing here? Internal monologue.
Yeah.
Because you feel like an imposter. So it's the same no matter, you know, the second you start creating. That's what I tend to feel like. But you just have to work through that. And then the process is myself and Darren, or for the past few shows, myself, Darren, and Andrew O'Connor, who is the other co-writer and co-director, who's brilliant. You talk about tricks that you like. Or wouldn't it be great to do this? Wouldn't it be amazing to do faith healing without faith? Is it possible to do that?
Okay.
Is it possible to do faith healing without Jesus being mentioned?
Okay.
To get an audience to a state that evangelical ministers get them to, where you could get someone walking who can't walk, cure ailments, and do it legitimately. How the hell? Oh, my God, how are we going to do that?
Right.
Is the start of the conversation. And then you sit staring at each other, bleeding from the eyes and ears, trying to find ways to do it, knowing that 9 weeks from now, you're in front of 3,000 people. So you better come up with something.
That you actually try that, like on opening night, and you start to get some bad reviews or coming in, you're thinking, we need to kind of tweak this a little bit. Or do you think, nope, this is a winner. They just haven't had a chance to understand.
No, you have to be brutally honest, and you have to look at it. So that's a great example of it. I mean, that was the last, I think that was the last but one stage show we did here. I think it was called Miracle, and that was it. That was the second half, basically, was faith healing without faith. And Darren is the most unbelievable performer, because he goes out there with, that's a great example of, it's not like you've got tried and tested material. You go out there with the script that we've written, in the hope that what you're going to do is going to work, it's going to work and have the linguistic effect that you want it to have.
Right.
And then you just hope. And if it doesn't, you start thinking, OK, how can we fix that? You only got two people up. Oh, my God. OK, so how can we help that? How can we get a dozen people standing instead of two? Because one of those people was clearly crazy and you couldn't get them on stage.
Right.
You know, they'd have stood no matter what. So how do we do that linguistically? What can we do? How can we make this work? What can you do? And you start shaping it. And that's what the previews are about.
Okay.
You know, you have a week of previews before you go to your, but again, Derren's previews are not to 12 people, it's to 1,000 people a night. You know, it's the sort of show most people dream of doing.
Were you involved with Secrets?
Yeah, I co-wrote and co-directed it.
Okay, because were you over here then in New York? Because I was there for one of the previews.
I was there for a few of the previews when it was off Broadway.
Okay, well, I was at the recent one, not off Broadway.
When it was on Broadway.
Yes.
So I wasn't there for the previews of that. I was doing a show in the West End here.
Oh, okay.
But I got there for like the final week of it.
Okay. But he was brilliant. I mean, yeah, just one man who was standing there and completely had everybody in the palm of his hand from the moment he sat on the chair just and talked for like 5 or 10 minutes about his life. It's like, wow, I love this man. I mean,
he's an amazing person.
He is. Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing there, and it's something I think a lot about with magic, you know, we're working on our 8th, I think, stage show at the moment, of which I've co-written and co-directed 7. And I was adamant, I spend half of my life in the theatre, either being in plays or musicals or seeing them or... And as a family, we're obsessed with it. And it was really, really important that when you went to see when we first started doing these stage shows with Darren and I, it was really important that you weren't going to see a magician doing tricks.
Right.
You had to go as an audience for a piece of theatre. Mm-hmm. We wanted to take an audience on a journey so you'd come out feeling you'd seen a show as opposed to a series of tricks, that you would laugh, that maybe there were moments where we could aspire to move you emotionally, that maybe there were moments where you'd see things visually that felt, whoa, that's fantastic. You know, right. All of the emotions that you should feel when you go and see a great play or a great musical or, you know, because magic is a really amazing art form.
It is emotional.
It is emotional. And it's so often not done justice when you see it. And I think one of the reasons is magicians don't tend to rely on an outside eye. So you'll work on a trick and then you just go out and start doing it. Or if you're putting a show together, you'll put your show together and hope it's okay, and out you go and start doing it.
Right.
You know, finding somebody
who has a critical eye,
mm-hmm. who is part of your team, who you can trust, who isn't in competition with you, who can look at it and go, you know what? I think that you need to throw that joke away. It's not, you shouldn't say that anymore. Or that trick's not strong enough. Let's find it. I like that bit of it, but this just doesn't work. Or that should be your closer. Or what about if you opened with this? You do that thing. Can we not? Let's just try that. Do you know what I mean? You have, and that's how you find and shape, as opposed to just going out and doing it on your own.
Right. Too few people, number one, want to have someone give you that kind of critical input, because that you have made this baby and you hate to have people say it's ugly. Second of all, that most magicians think we can do it all, which includes directing, producing, scripting, and too few people actually do script, and rehearsing, and marketing, building your website, everything else that you're doing. They tend to do it all, as opposed to putting us out to people who are professionals who could do something. You need to bring in somebody who can have that outside objective.
Yeah, and I think in fairness, Scott, some of that comes from, if you're doing it semi-pro, then it's like, well, it doesn't really matter that much because I've got my proper job and I'm doing this as a hobby and it's fine. I don't really want to invest.
But it reflects on the rest of us.
I know. But if you're doing it as a pro as well, it's hard to make a living.
Right.
And you come to a point where you think, well, great, but I don't really want to spend $500 on getting someone to have a look at this when I've got that bill coming up and we've got the mortgage and I've got this. It's a hell of an investment. What am I going to get in return?
Right.
What if I get Scott Wells to come and look at my act and I've paid him that chunk of money and he tells me nothing that's useful? I've just thrown that money away. So I get the reticence to do it. Mm-hmm. So that's not about don't hire Scott Wells.
No,
I'm just saying in general, that's the point, isn't it? And again, that runs right into my imposter syndrome again, because I do get asked by people, you know, could I work with them for a day or so, or how much would it cost?
Yeah.
And
you have a good track record. I mean,
I do, but nevertheless, that doesn't mean every time I do it, I start that day thinking, the hell am I going to say to them? How am I going to help them? I haven't got a clue. Mm-hmm. And you just, there's a brilliant thing I learned actually from my writing partner, is my oldest friend, a guy called Jeremy Dyson. So he's not with Darren stuff. He and I wrote a play called Ghost Stories. That was on in the West End and has now been on all over the world, and we made a movie of it.
I saw the movie. That was great.
Did you?
I did.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
I love horror movies and things like that. And if we get a chance to kind of get around to that, I would like to talk a little bit about horror films.
Oh, try and stop me. So Jeremy and I wrote that and directed that. And Jeremy is a writer and a director, obviously, but a writer by profession and has done that for 30 plus years, and is, you know, much, much admired, rightly so. And one of the things he says a lot, and I've really learned from him, is you have to trust the process.
Good advice. Trust the process.
And it's really, really interesting. And it's really amazing that, going back to that thing where someone employs me and I sort of think, oh, I don't know if I'm going to be able to deliver, I've yet to have a day really where I've come away and thought, well, I haven't made, you know, I always come away and think I have actually done a good job and I thought I made that better for them. And my process on those days is always the same. I just ask them questions about them and we start talking and look at their act and it finds itself. And that's the same when you're creating anything else. It's the same with a Derringer. You've got to trust the process. You've got to know there are going to be gaping holes of silence where you despair, and then you push through that, and then you get to the other side and suddenly someone goes, what about if we did that? And oh, you know what we could do, it, and then you're off again, you know. And the process is always the same. And it's the same thing if you want to create magic tricks. You don't have to create it on a Wednesday afternoon and be out there doing it on a Friday. You can write the idea down and think, you know, I want to hold up an empty scotch glass and have it fill up with single malt. And I drink it and it's empty and then it fills up again. How am I going to do that? And you just write that idea down.
Right.
In a book. Don't put it on your computer. I mean, back it up on a computer, sure, but write it in a notepad. There's something about the tactile process. You write it down. And then the next day you sort of wake up and think, ooh, what? I wonder if you could do like those milk glasses, if that, you could, there was a way of it being looking empty. And then you, I mean, what do I know? Well, there's a mirror glass. I could sort of use that, or this or that. No, I don't. Okay. Just write those in there anyway.
Sure.
And then
no bad ideas.
Later, come back and you look at it again, and a week later, and who knows, 3 years later, you suddenly go, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
I know exactly what it is, you know. And you got to let creativity breathe. Sometimes that the temptation is, it's a balance of letting it breathe and having a deadline. You want to have both of those things in flux, because sometimes you need that dead, you need that little bit of fire under your tuchus to just keep you. Okay, come on, come on, come on, come on. Because the other truism is perfect is the enemy of good. Which is also really true, where you think, well, no, I won't do that yet. I'll just wait till it's perfect. And there's no such thing. It will never be perfect. Mm-hmm. I look at the Ghost Stories film now and think, oh God, if I could have an afternoon in the edit, I could change that bit that really bothers me and change that and that and that. And you know, you've published books. You proofread them 1,000 times.
Right.
Goes to the publisher. The first time you open the actual book, the first thing you do is spot a mistake.
Yeah.
And just think, oh, how did I not see that? I started to think about them as, you know, those sort of Persian carpets that they deliberately put mistakes into to prove they're not as perfect as God. Yeah. That's the thing. Persian, one of those beautiful carpets, there's always a mistake. That's what I think of every time I have a mistake. I think it's proof. It's proof I'm not God.
Well, do you think it's more difficult to have a for the process to in creating something or in working on a script for a new play or the play itself or perhaps for television or for a movie?
Do you mean as an actor versus a creator?
Yes, I mean as an actor.
As my acting career has grown, I mean, I've been doing that's my what I consider to be my main career.
I just wondered whether that television and movies is different in your process than for live theater, because you got to get up for every performance as opposed to once you're done, it's in the can, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah. Well, with TV and film, it's very strange because they are completely different processes to theatre. Because theatre, on a play or a musical, whatever, you'll get 4 or 5 weeks of rehearsal where you think about every line and you'll do it and the director will be like, what do you think this is? Or what do you think this is about? Or what if you tried that or this? And bit by bit by bit, you dig, or I like, the way I work is I dig and dig into the character and I make notes and you try things and you be as brave as you can. And after 4, 5, 6 weeks of doing that, you know what you're doing and you get out there and you do it. And then the audience tells you the rest. You know, you're feeding off each other. Theatre and film is no rehearsal whatsoever. It's completely DIY. So yeah. you're living on your own instincts and you learn it to the point where you won't freeze in terror when you get on set and realize, oh my God, there are 70 people here
waiting for me.
Waiting for me and lights and camera. And this must be costing a fortune. And oh my God, that's Renée Zellweger or whoever, you know, like in the Judy film. Or whatever it is, whoever you're working with, doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a star, but to the point where, you know, I'm solid. And then you just do it. You jump out the plane and every now, you know, the director, if they're a good director, may say, great, let's try one this time. And maybe, but more often than not, you'll get, you happy? Should we do one more? Great. Okay. Do one more. That's it. Okay, moving on. Thank you.
Wow. Okay.
And so, but I've really learned a huge amount over the past few years. My acting, I think, has changed dramatically over the past few years through accident more than anything. Part of it, I think, is the confidence of being older and experienced. But I had a real breakthrough. I was doing, it's a show that I think is on Netflix in the States, a thing called Wanderlust. And it's with Toni Collette, and it's about a marriage guidance counsellor. And I play a character who is going for therapy with his wife. And it's an unbelievably beautifully written script. Very difficult to learn, actually, because the way it's written, and again, you realize the value of a script. And again, what few magicians actually do is write a proper script or think about what is the effect on an audience going to be when they hear this. But this is beautifully written script, and it's hard to learn because it's written in a way whereby it'll be, when I think we're with, the point I'm trying to, you know, no sentence really completes.
Exactly.
Because he's a man who's trying to delicately find what he wants to say without offending his wife or what he feel he can say to the therapist. So it was an incredibly complex thing to learn. Big, big speeches.
Because there's a lot of stuff going on in that person's mind, and you have to get in the mind of that person to think, okay, I'm not going to finish that sentence because, I understand what you're saying.
Well, that's exactly it. So what I always do is I actually write for myself what the rest of that sentence is that I'm not going to say.
Oh,
And then I write why I'm not going to say it. And that can be, there can be 30 reasons.
That's your internal script.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's my pages look, scrawling. I love that.
Well, when you're working like as the creative director then for Darren Brown, do you stop him? And when you're like practicing, you're rehearsing?
Huge amounts. And that's why Darren's so amazing. I don't mean because of me, but Darren is so amazing because he treats it like an actor giving a performance and he wants notes. So the notes I will give Darren after a performance are, they'll be twofold. The first thing is you've got your technical stuff, which will be, I think if you move, then we're going to see the sneaky bit you're doing. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you stand your ground a moment and let them move first, try that. I think that really will help that or whatever.
Sure.
So you'll have the nuts and bolts direction, but then the main direction is script led. Is that moment's not landing, or God, that's brilliant the way you deliver that, whatever you're thinking there, think that, or I think that this needs to feel a little bit more like this.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's about that, and just let it breathe a little bit. Why are you saying it like that? What's that about? Okay, let's try it like that, and let's try it like that. So it's like any other actor and director.
But you were also involved with the script writing at that as well.
We write it together as well. And the way it tends to work is that Darren will write the main body of the script.
Okay.
So we'll work on a routine, me, Darren and Andrew. Darren will go away and formulate a script, or often we'll do it in the room. We'll kind of improvise it. So it's sort of this. Sometimes mm-hmm. I'll get up and sort of do, is it like this? Blah, 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 blah. Or Darren will go, oh, yeah, but not that. It's the, you know. And then Darren will go away and write in Darren's voice and come back and do it for me and Andrew. And then, what do you think? And it's like, I loved that. I loved the first half. I got really confused in the second half. Or I hated the first half, but God, the second half. Well, that bit in the middle, that's what the routine is. It's
right.
About that sentence there. Let's just try throwing everything else away. No, I love that bit. Just hang on a minute. Let's do this. Let's do that.
Right.
And you start finding what it is. And the only way you can really get to what it really is to not be precious about it. So you have to be prepared to throw the stuff away, to trust the process, because it might be after the first preview, you go, you know what? You remember that thing you wrote? I think we should try it. It may really work. You were right. Or whatever it is.
That. Again, going back to trust the process, because it has to all come back to that, basically.
Well, no, that's the other thing I've really learned. No work is wasted.
Yeah, exactly.
It really isn't. You know, every little bit you create, every little trick you try and invent that goes nowhere, that feels like what a waste of 6 months and 200 quid that was. It's not. You don't know when that's going to pay off. And that's another thing with magic, Scott, that kills me, is that when you hear people, oh, I'm the mentalist guy, or I do kids parties, that's all I do, or I'm the this guy, I don't like, you know, it's so naive to me. You just want to soak it all up. Mm-hmm. That's why Greater Magic, Al Baker, whatever else we mentioned earlier, Mark right. Wilson, that's why they're such mm-hmm. brilliant books. But you look at a guy like Al Baker, brilliant kids magician,
mm-hmm.
brilliant parlor magician, the most fooling mentalism,
right,
brilliant card magician. It's all the same stuff.
All like Martin Gardner. There'd be another one I want to throw in there.
100%.
Yeah.
It's all the same thinking. And I cannot tell you how many times, because I probably did 1,000 kids parties.
Mm-hmm.
And how many times when I was inventing close-up stuff or whatever, I think, oh, there's that thing I used to do with an Oreo cookie at a kids party.
Yeah.
God, if that was a coin, could you do? Nothing is wasted, you know, and we shouldn't be snobby about any of it. You just want to look at it all and soak it up and love. That's why we do it. You know,
that's true. And there are, as Eugene Berger had said, so many rooms in the House of Magic over there.
Scott, there are so many rooms in the house.
God, I miss it.
Boy, I do too. That's true.
I had so many laughs with him.
A funny story. I was sitting with him and Larry Haas one time for breakfast, and I was recording an episode of the podcast that was going to be The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. And so I had a bunch of different people who had played the voices of the people from Whoville and everything, and I wanted his voice to be the voice of the Grinch. And he had never heard of The Grinch Who Stole Christmas. He didn't know the story. He said, "Who is this Grinch? I don't understand." And Larry and his wife were just laughing. He said, "You got to be kidding me, you know." So I had the part for him of what I wanted him to say that I would edit in with everything else, because he had just the perfect voice, you know, for The Grinch. That was the original was voiced by Boris Karloff way back when, who had a great voice. And I think that Eugene would be the perfect person for it. And it worked out great, but it was just so funny. Just that I never heard of this Grinch character.
Classic. Yeah.
But what a guy. But the point I was going to get back to was how that you had gotten more into mentalism. And I think that we all kind of go through different phases that we like illusions or doves or rabbits or, you know, stage or close up or coins or cards. And then you go to mentalism or escapes or, I mean, again, so many different rooms. And so your journey kind of had a lot of background to it as well, that and we call on all these things, I think, at different times in our lives as we get older, that we can then put them into saying, well, what if I use this move that is a good sleight that will work, not, I mean, a coin move that would work actually for a billet switch or something.
Totally.
You know? Yeah. So in your case, that did you kind of do the same thing? I mean, and ultimately kind of stopped at mentalism, or is that something that?
I love it all. I absolutely love it. I mean, you know, my bookshelves are full of all sorts of stuff. Mentalism for me, I mean, you know, it seems impossible for, I mean, not for you or you know, magicians of my age, but there was a time when mentalism was not fashionable. You know,
I've got stories about that too. Sure, exactly.
I mean, it's incredible. Yeah. But, you know, post Derren, really, Derren has birthed this in the way that Blaine sort of rebirthed close up / street magic and gave it a whole new feel. Derren is 22 years into his career or whatever he is. Well, mentalism has been unbelievably fashionable for that amount of time. That was not the case. Mentalism was the stuffy, long ignored bit of a joke. I know what you're thinking style. Now, you had Kreskin, but we didn't have anyone, really.
Well, that's true. So, we didn't have very many. Well, you had a few people then who were over there and doing that. Of course, that David Berglas was. And
absolutely. But he would never call himself a mentalist.
No. But there was, I'm trying to think of the other guy who did the book test.
Well, you've got Graham Jolly.
Okay, Graham Jolly. But there was an older guy than that, even. And it wasn't David Nixon, but there was another fellow that used to do things, I want to say maybe in the 1950s or 60s. And he
I'm going to name. That's unbelievable. Okay. Yeah, well, obviously Chan Canasta, but there was...
I think it may have been Chan Canasta I was thinking of.
It was Canasta, was it?
Yes.
You were thinking of?
Yes.
Oh, Canasta's unbelievable. But no, there's the famous British one who people always slightly compared me to because he was a stocky Jewish guy with curly hair. What the hell was his name? Oh, that's terrible.
But I recall whenever that I was trying, working with Banachek on our original project, which was Radio Magic, and we were trying to sell the cassette tapes. And I remember talking to Joe Stevens, and this was back in the 80s, like 87. Yeah. And he said, nobody, first of all, knows whose name is Steve Shaw. Number two is that nobody's going to buy mentalism. Mentalism is not hot. Obviously, things changed. It took a long time. We found someone else who did believe in it, and it kind of blossomed from there. But
yeah, but what I loved was when I sort of discovered it. One of the things I loved was as an actor, it was a very pure performance thing. And as magic, I knew very early on when I started doing it, this is really the only form of magic that has a proper question mark for an audience, a proper. What the hell is going on? because they know the woman's not sawn in half. Doesn't matter how brilliant it is, and I love all that stuff, but they know, oh, well, I don't know what's happening, but that is one hell of a puzzle.
Yes.
That there is a complicit game they are playing.
But there are some people who actually do believe in magic. I mean, you've had people come to you saying, isn't most of magic really just tricks and everything, implying that there must be 5 or 10% that must be real. So some people believe some part of this must be magic.
Look, you're going to get... Well, with mentalism, I would say the bell curve is much greater.
Well, that's true.
A good 70% of people believe it. But with regular magic, I mean, there are people who have fundamental Christian beliefs or other religious beliefs that believe it's evil, that believe that the devil is involved, blah, blah, blah. But the vast majority of people who don't hold strong beliefs, they know that what they're seeing, they might not articulate it, but they know what they're seeing is conjuring, and it's a great mysterious art that has amazing moments of wonder and shock and awe, but they don't genuinely think, wow, that coin has this person knows how to dematerialize solid matter and make it reappear elsewhere.
Like in Houdini, when they thought that he dematerialized from that trunk for the metamorphosis.
But that's, people don't really, 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 really think that. Sane people don't think that.
Right.
Really. Mm-hmm. Whereas with mentalism, they absolutely cannot. There's a very interesting game that happens psychologically, I believe, with mentalism, which is either you saw what I just wrote down, which I don't know how you could have done that. Oh, my God, how could he have read my thoughts?
Right.
You know, they either go, well, the only conclusion must be that, but that's boring, so we'll kill that. So what else could it be? You know, it's an amazing thing that happens with mentalism. So I very, very much loved that sense that it had with it, because as an actor, it meant the world was your oyster. And also, as, you know, a married man with two young children who, when he was out of work as an actor, was making a living doing kids parties or close up or whatever. Nobody, and I mean Scott, nobody was doing mentalism. So it meant I came up with a sort of cool act. And it meant I could charge three times what I was charging for close up.
Because you were
unique. Instead of 2 hours of close up, I had to do half an hour of mentalism for, you know, three times the amount of money. So I thought, I'll do this.
Sure.
So I very quickly in that world became much in demand and became, you know, sort of I don't mean this arrogantly. It's hard not to sound like that. I truly don't. But I think I've done it long enough that I see that I think I was certainly at the forefront of the shift of what mentalism has become. You know, I in terms of modernizing mentalism and taking the stuff that I liked and giving it a spin, be that from Killer Elite and then into Derren's work and giving a new breath of life that feels like it's at a point now where someone else needs to come along and shift it. Not again, because it's dead, because it isn't, but who wants to see a copy of Derren? Nobody. So you want to feel what's going to be next.
Right.
In it.
Well, why? Because you were doing this before Derren, I assume.
Yeah.
And so why isn't it you instead of Derren? Or did you really want to take the back seat?
They wanted me to do it. So I was offered I got a phone call out of the blue saying, we want to offer you a 1 hour special on Channel 4 called Mind Control. And so I said, no, I'm not interested. I'm an actor. It won't make me happy. That's all I care about. So this was Andrew O'Connor and Michael Vine. And they said, well, let's take you for lunch and talk about it. So I was great. OK, so we went for lunch. And bear in mind, I was in my early 30s. I was married, mortgage, two young kids, out of work actor, waiting to hear from bits and bobs I was going up for.
Right.
And they offered me what they thought would be a 5-year deal to have a primetime TV show, and figured it would be more money. You know, they showed me what they thought I'd probably earn, and it was more money than I would had ever earned in my life at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I just said, oh, I don't know. Just, it won't make me happy. That's all I care about. Scott, that is genuinely all I care about. Life's too short. I don't, you know, I'm blessed to have things that I love aside from my family, things that I'm passionate about, acting more than anything else, aside from family, obviously, acting, writing, magic, directing. But acting is my number one. And I was just, no. But I did say, whoever you find, I'll write with them and direct them because you like my ideas. When that was the thing I look back and I think, thank God I said that.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is.
And so they found Darren and brought him to you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they said, do you want to work together? And I'd seen Darren and, you know, I would never have had the career Darren's had because I'm not that person. You know, Darren's one in a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
He's the real deal.
But was he a mentalist before the television found him?
Oh, God, yeah. He was doing the most amazing card magic and absolutely revolutionary mentalism. You know, before anything, I'd seen him at this Macmillan's convention.
Yeah, that weekend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'd seen his act. He was in the competition. And I'm knowledgeable. I know a lot about close-up and I know a lot about mentalism. And I sat and watched this guy doing this and I felt sick. I just thought, I don't know what's going on. Wow. Either these guys are stooges or I am, forgive me for swearing, because this is not. And also, this guy is freaking me out.
Yeah.
He's doing stuff I cannot work out. I think he's hypnotized this guy. His thinking was absolutely revolutionary. He got someone in the audience to take a coin out of their pocket, not stooged.
Right.
Grab a coin, look at it, and he told them the year.
Holy moly.
He didn't fish, just did it.
Wow.
It was all written up in his new books. His thinking was and is remarkable. That's not who I am. You know, I have, you know, we're a very good yin and yang.
That's good.
You know, we work really well together in terms of he goes off on flights of fancy. I'll pull him back. I'll be too grounded. He'll pull me up. You know, we have, sure. It really works. And
that's
always
a good relationship.
Done. It's wonderful. But, you know, after I'd have done one special for Channel 4 and then be like, okay, do you think I can be in Channel 4 films now as an actor? I'd have just jumped ship. I wouldn't have been interested. You know, Darren has grown into this giant of a performer, writes these wonderful books that change people's lives. Mm-hmm. He's amazing. And thank God my career has flourished, you know, as an actor and a writer and a director in its own form. So we have this great relationship, but it's never interested me to do it as a career, as a hobby that feeds my life emotionally and artistically and financially. Magic has changed my life, and I'm so grateful to it for that.
Well, that's a good place to end, and for me to ask my last question, of course, of what your magic word is. What is your philosophy of life? I mean, this has obviously changed your life. So what is it that is your magic word? Your philosophy. What's your phrase? What is it that you live by?
So I have two books that I wrote there's The Golden Rules of Acting and More Golden Rules of Acting. They're books for actors, but okay. They're for anybody. It doesn't matter. It's basically how to survive as a freelancer. And they're funny. And there are lots of quotes and things in there. And there's a quote from George Burns that's almost the first thing in the first book. Mm-hmm. And when I heard it, it honestly became a mantra for me. And it's this. I'd rather be a failure at something I love than a success at something I hate.
Hmm.
And that has honestly been how I've tried to live my life, by just pursuing what I love, knowing that I'll do other things to make us survive if I need to.
Sure.
But the pursuit of love, things that you love, what that puts into the world, what that is as an example to my children and my family, that's all I ever try to do.
Pursue what you love.
Pursue what you love.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Wow. And you've lived by that. I mean, it's interesting that you have that perspective and the foresight, I guess, to say, this is my direction and I'm going to put on some blinders. Yes, these other things, kind of these little frilly things look attractive. However, that my focus must be this because my goal is this, which is why that I constantly tell people to set those goals. Otherwise, any direction is fine. But you need to know where you're going. And then if it's something's not contributing towards that, then leave that out. Keep focused.
Yeah.
So, yeah, pursue what you love. Yeah. I love that. Andy, this has been just absolutely wonderful. Thank you so very much
Thank
for
you,
your time.
Scott. My great pleasure. And thank you for asking me. It's lovely to do it.
Great conversation. So from was it Leicester? Are you in Leicester? Or are you in London?
Well, I'm in London. I've lived in London for 30 since 1980. Where are we? 1984.
Yeah.
My God. Yeah, I've lived here a long time, but I'm from Leicester originally.
And so from London, England, then. Thanks again. That was Andy Nyman. This is Scotty out. Man, I wish I had a voice like Andy. I tell you, it's so calm and soothing. It's one of those things, I think if I were to listen to him just, I don't care, read nursery rhymes or anything at night, I could go to sleep so much easier just to the lilt of his voice. He just has not only great diction, but just a very soothing voice. Thank you, Andy, again for being a guest. This week has been really wonderful, and some of the nuggets that you dropped on here were just wonderful. I mean, talking about the imposter principle, that was interesting. Another thing, a little nugget I thought was to trust the process. That was very valuable. I really loved hearing about that. And also something you kind of mentioned along the way, that perfect is the enemy of good. That is something to ponder, something for us to think about. Well, again, you gave us a lot to think about and to learn, and appreciate you sharing your wisdom with us here this week on the podcast. And I want to encourage the listeners to come back each week and also to be sure and subscribe to the Pod Letter. As we reach 1,000 people who have subscribed to the Pod Letter, I will announce that person's name as soon as we hit 1,000. And so hopefully it'll be coming up fairly soon. And also, if you have not yet subscribed to the YouTube channel, that is youtube.com/Texas Magician, please do that. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to be a failure at something you love rather than being a success at something that you hate. And to always pursue what you love. This is Scotty out.